Accession number 28354, Reel 21.
You have medicine. Yeah, I feel I should.
So William, thank you very much indeed for continuing with your contribution to the Sound Archive. I think today might see us come to the end of your naval career, possibly. We'll see how we go. And I think that we will we finished the last tape with almost the conclusion of your time in the Far East, but I think you have one or two more stories to tell, and in particular something relating possibly to Chinese stewards, which you have mentioned.
Yeah, I feel I should talk about them, because the service one received generally in the Navy from cooks and stewards really was wonderful, whether they were Chinese or otherwise. But truly marvellous were the Chinese. They were quite a class on their own as personal servants and as servants within a wardroom or a ship. And I had one called Petty Officer Ah Koo when I was Captain of Cheviot. And Ah Koo had been a young steward before the war. When war came, somebody advised him to get out of Hong Kong. And he went into China. And he acted as a linesman for General Stillwell's army in China. Then crept back to Hong Kong when the war ended, where he was met by a paymaster commander who recognized him, said, "Come on, come back in the Navy." And he came back in the Navy, and from then on he was on the staff of the Captain D 8th Destroyer Squadron. And I think I was probably the 8th or 9th Captain D who he had served. And everybody loved Ah Koo. He was a Wei Hai Wei Chinese, that's he spoke Mandarin. And most of the other Chinese stewards came from Hong Kong and therefore spoke Cantonese. Ah Koo learned Cantonese, but was never really happy taking charge of Cantonese, so he liked to be on his own in a captain's pantry where he was his own little master, and therefore he stayed as Captain D's steward. And he was uniquely wonderful. I'll give one example. I told Ah Koo, "I'm going ashore." This was in Hong Kong. "I'm going ashore and I'm going to stay ashore for supper. Go home and see your wife. You haven't seen her for a long time because we've been at sea." And he nodded his head, and I went ashore and I met lots of friends in some restaurant or other, or club or whatever, and I said, "Come on, there's bound to be something in the fridge, come back on board and we'll find something to eat." Came back on board, and Ah Koo wasn't only there, he was laying the supper. He knew perfectly well that I was going to come back. I didn't. I was sure, absolutely certain I was going to stay ashore. But it was that kind of intuitive service. I mean, you'd hardly tapped a cigarette out. I did smoke in those days in an ashtray before either he or Can, the other steward, were in there giving you a clean one. It was real service. So it was a great pleasure, actually, just while I was commanding the Far East Fleet, that I was able, Ah Koo retired, and I was able to present him with a wonderful certificate which I'd had arranged. I got every single one of his captains to sign it. The final one I got was the first Sea Lord, Varel Begg, and I got him to sign it on the day that he, Varel Begg, left the job, because on that day he was an Admiral of the Fleet. So Ah Koo has this lovely certificate in a silver frame, etc., which he was pretty proud of. But then all this time in Singapore when I was commanding the Far East Fleet, again, the most wonderful team of stewards, in this case, except for the chief steward and the wine steward, all local Singapore Chinese, and therefore Hainanese mostly. But the top two were, again, Mandarin-speaking. Chung was a huge man. He was about 6'1", most unusual for a Chinese. Great big body, huge legs, a Buddhist, and a quite wonderful servant in every possible way. And he had very attractive trays. For example, my wife decided to have chickens, and we got half a dozen or a dozen chickens. And one day, the day came when they laid an egg. And Chung said to my wife, "Come on, we'll go down to the chickens and thank the first chicken for laying the egg." He loved animals and he's a Buddhist and wouldn't kill them. But, and my wife said, "How will you know which one it is?" Oh, said, "Oh, she'll come to us." And they went down to the chickens, and sure enough, up walked a chicken to a Chung. He picked her up and she sat clucking in his arms. My wife said it quite obviously was the one that laid the egg. This was this lovely, nice man. One day my wife's coming back from Singapore and she stopped off at a I think it's a Redemptorist convent where they had a what was known as a permanent, a perpetual novena. There were always people praying and watching. And there were huge numbers of Chinese in there. My wife dropped in and saw this and was very impressed and came back and said to Chung, the scenist, and she'd no idea that so many Chinese were Christians. So many Chinese were Catholics. And Chung said, Chinese people become Catholic, not Christian. And another good thing about of religion with him was when the Chaplain of the Fleet was coming out, and Chaplain of the Fleet got flu, couldn't come, so there was a signal saying he wasn't arriving. Everything was arranged. So my wife said to Chung, Chaplain of the Fleet not coming. Cancel everything. And Chung turned on his heels and saying, God, no good, and walked away. But these are all silly stories, but they were such wonderful servants. Going back to the ordinary steward, I can remember having a leading steward, Brunel, who taught me a great lesson. That's to say, you want to watch your steps with the stewards, because there was a sort of mafia, a sort of stewards intercommunication links, which was evident one day when we were going to stay with another admiral in his official residence. And I noticed leading steward Brunel packing a lot of coat hangers. I said, surely we don't know those. I mean, fine coat hangers. Not in that house, sir. They'll all be metal ones. And they were. So these little buzzes got round. They knew your habits. One had to be careful. Right, I think that's enough about stewards.
We were going to mention two other types of steward.
Oh, I'm sorry. We were going to talk about the unofficials. In every ship in the Far East, you had the unofficials, and they were the tailor, the laundryman, and the shoemaker. Doby, obviously what he was, Shushu, and So-So, obviously what they were. And these people used to... You didn't give them... It's terrible what we did. We didn't give them any space. We didn't give them any space to live. We didn't give them any space to work. They just found the space in passageways down outside magazines. They had their shop and produced wonderful stuff. Very good shoes, well-made clothes. Were quite extraordinarily good considering what conditions we gave them.
And did they earn their salaries really from you personally, not from the Navy?
Not from the Navy, no, entirely from their work. Yeah.
So the Navy had people who were not members of the Navy, who were not paid by the Navy.
That's right.
Merely fed by the Navy, who had no official space.
I don't know how they fed. I don't think the Navy fed them officially. They certainly got fed. And it was the perks obviously were very good for them, because when I moved, when I was appointed in command of HMS Hermes, the previous So-So and Doby, whom I'd had in a destroyer before, happened to be in England in another ship. They came all the way down from Rosyth to my flat in London where we were living in order to lobby me to get the job of laundryman and tailor in HMS Hermes, obviously a much bigger ship and better perks. And indeed they came down with all the bribes. The Doby man had great bolts of wonderful Thai silk to offer my wife, dress lengths of Missy and everything. I'm afraid I couldn't give them the job because there already were people in place in that particular. But it was a sought-after job for many Chinese, yes. Shall we move on now from the Far East?
And, certainly.
I recorded earlier my surprise when I was told I was going to be an acting vice admiral commander of Far East Fleet, and I said that I had thought that when I was made rear admiral I was going to be ACNS, and I wasn't. I became naval secretary. Now, as a vice admiral going home, I was all the buzzes were that I was going as second sea lord, and I assumed that's probably what I would do, having been naval secretary and other jobs with personnel. That seemed quite logical. So again, it was an enormous surprise when Mike Leffenhew, then the then First Sea Lord, wrote to me, to say that I was going to go as an acting admiral, another step up before my time, so to speak, as Commander-in-Chief Western Fleet, as it was then called. That was a wonderful surprise, gave me a great pleasure. I'd much, again, much rather be commanding a fleet or commanding anything than in the Admiralty. So off my wife and I went to Northwood in, I suppose, something like February of 1970, something like that, to relieve John Bush. I already spoken somewhere else about turnover notes and how valueless I'd found them. John Bush gave me a comprehensive rundown of his fleet and everything else, but I always remember one absolutely useless note he made. He said, the standing naval force Atlantic, this was under his NATO hat, the standing naval force Atlantic is a cocktail party outfit that goes around the capitals of Europe giving receptions, etc. Don't worry about it, Bill. Don't think about it. There are many more important things. Almost the first signal I got was from an American destroyer in the standing naval force Atlantic, then up at the northern Norway, because he'd run aground. So, and it's a wonderful signal. This captain made a signal saying, have struck a low-profile island. The island was of such low profile, it was actually underwater. The standing naval force Atlantic came to my attention almost at the beginning of my time. Now, this job was Commander-in-Chief Western Fleet, Commander-in-Chief Eastern Atlantic under a NATO hat, and CNC Channel, and again a NATO hat. And as CNC Channel, one was on the equivalent level as Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic and Supreme Allied Commander Europe. This is one of the compromises that the British government managed to get when these great supreme commands were set up. We had somebody at the same level. That was lost soon after, about two admirals after me. Tsing Chan, really a bit absurd when you think of the Channel Command, isn't a very great era to be on the same level as these two was odd. But it gave you a position in the military committee. It gave us a military foothold, so to speak, in the very centre. I can't pretend that I made much use of it or found that it was really terribly useful, but it was extremely interesting to be at the higher levels of military discussion in NATO.
Can I just ask you a question,
yeah.
If I may? You said that you were delighted to go back in command, rather than go into the Admiralty.
Yeah.
If you had gone into the Admiralty, do you think that would have increased, thereby, because it increased your knowledge of Whitehall, you might have stood a better chance later of going on?
Conceivably, but I'm not sure that a Second Sea Lord's job is one that grooms you for the First Sea Lord's job. It's quite so different. Vice Chief of Naval Staff, yes, that would groom you for it. I don't think this possibly would. The other bit of turnover John Bush gave me was that my opposite number in the Air Force was, of course, CNC Strike Command, just over the way at High Wycombe. And that was Air Chief Marshal Spottiswood, subsequently Chief of Air Staff. And John told me that you never get on with Spottiswood. He was absolutely, totally impossible, and life was difficult with him. And I said to myself, well, that John Bush is known as a prickly, awkward chap to get on with. I'm much easier, I'm much better at getting on with people than John is, I'm sure. I'll get on with Spottiswood. But John was right. I didn't. I found him absolutely impossible. Impossible, just very difficult person to cooperate with. Nothing. We never seemed to agree. We never liked each other either. That was sad. I don't think he was a great airman, actually. His successor, whose name I've now forgotten...
Might it have been John Grandy?
No.
Well,
just a second. I get me down. His successor, who unfortunately died before he became Chief of the Air Staff, That was quite a different matter. I got on with that terribly well. That was very nice. We had a very such a pleasant association. See, there was a difficulty here with the Air Force in that under the NATO structure, the Air Marshal commanding Coastal Command, it was called, I can't remember what group it was a 204 group or something. Anyway, what used to be Coastal Command, was in his NATO hat subordinate to me. I could tell the AOC what to do in a NATO environment, but I couldn't tell him what to do in a national one. That had to go through Spotswood, because he was subordinate to Spotswood nationally. Very awkward, really a very awkward setup. And as the airman, my airman officer number, this air marshal, was entirely on my side in this. He saw the so to speak, the unity of command. This is what made it difficult with Spotswood. Spotswood also was determined to become Commander in Chief Eastern Atlantic in a NATO hat. He hadn't got a NATO hat. And I was equally determined that he shouldn't become Commander in Chief Eastern Atlantic, because once again that was another level of command, so to speak, which introduced. I thought NATO had got it right, and we hadn't.
I can just tell you, whilst you're thinking of the next point, that when I was speaking with Michael Pollock, who had to work with Spotswood when he was chief of the air staff, he said that he was impossible to work with.
Oh, really?
Yes, and I asked, oh, why? And he said that he could never understand. He was permanently light blue, was Michael Pollock's expression. He could never understand that you had to have, there were two shades of blue, that they had to mix from time to time, and, of course, the army as well. Mm. And he never grasped that point.
Yes.
He just stuck out all the time what the Air Force wanted or the Air Force view without any accommodation of the other services.
Well, we all have the same experience, apparently. Yes. I'm trying to think of the name of my airman, Bobby. He's dead now, sadly, but it doesn't matter. We got on very well. My association with him, other than the first meeting, was very good. Almost the first thing we did was go around and have dinner with the Air Marshal. He invited us round. Admiralty House in Northwood, I wasn't very satisfied with it. I thought the furnishings were pretty awful and the pictures were inadequate. I thought we could have some better pictures than that in the Commander-in-Chief's house. Anyway, we went to dinner with this man, and there was he had the most beautiful furniture everywhere, most wonderful dwarf long case clock, etc., all Regency, all as handsome as could be. And I went back to Admiralty House bitterly complaining, and somebody said, "But don't you know, sir?" I said, "No." He said, "The Air Marshal is the most wonderful cabinet maker. He's made all of those," and he had indeed, he'd made the lot. They were magnificent. When he moved house, that chap, he had two pantechnicons, one with his furniture, the other with his lathes and his equipment. He was really professional. Beautiful stuff. I'm trying to think where to go next, actually. At Northwood, at the headquarters, there were two headquarters, one underground, which was the NATO headquarters, and also my national operations room. And above ground was my national Western Fleet headquarters. So the day really started by my having read all my signals, etc., going down the tunnel to the NATO headquarters and being briefed there by my NATO chief of staff, who was a Rear Admiral Jan Klaver of the Dutch Navy. And under him was an international staff, American, Dutch, one French liaison officer, and Belgian, and ourselves, of course, divided into Sink Chan and Sink East Lance. This And this wasn't really divided. Some of these people overlapped. Some were in both commands. So Jan Klarov was my chief of staff, both as CNC Channel and as CNC Eastern Atlantic. It sounds as though it would be very difficult to separate all these. In fact, it wasn't. It all worked quite smoothly. Jan Klarov had been a prisoner of war in the and in Poland, actually. But he was taken early on in the war. And one thing we didn't agree with was religion. He absolutely detested Roman Catholics because he maintained that when he escaped from his prisoner of war camp, it was a Polish priest
gave him away.
Gave him away to the Germans. But he was a good man. He was tough, no nonsense Dutchman, and did the job extremely well. I was very fond of him. In my national headquarters, I had Rear Admiral Jimmison as chief of staff, and then again a big staff, as I'd had in the Far East, only bigger underneath. Having done my NATO stuff, I used to walk across to the operations room where the staff officer operations of my national staff would brief me as to what was going on in the fleet, and then you'd go back and do the administrative stuff up in the main office. Or all the various other things one had to do. The trouble with Northwood is about as far away from the sea as you can get in the United Kingdom. So in order to see anything of one's captains, they had to come all the way up to Northwood. And so all the entertainment I gave was really lunchtime. We had very little entertaining in the evening because people had to get, captains and other officers from the fleet had to get back to their ships. So I had a big lunch party almost every day. This is a very pleasant way of meeting some of my officers.
And was this with your wife or just...
Yes, no, with my wife and their wives.
And their wives.
Oh, yes, mixed. So we did all our social and official entertaining like that, with obviously the occasional dinner party. I obviously also, rather like in the Far East, used to travel around a lot, but not quite as much in this case. One obviously was going to Brussels quite often to NATO meetings, to Norfolk, Virginia for Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic meetings or the liaison with him. The Supreme Allied Commander was to start with a man called Ephraim Holmes, a very powerful personality, rather unimaginative American admiral actually, but I think quite a good and efficient one. Not an easy one to get friendly with, but quite a good man to work with. I quite enjoyed Ephraim Holmes, but his successor after him was Admiral Duncan, and I didn't think he really was up to Supreme Allied Commander standard. He didn't match up to Ephraim Holmes as a major admiral. He's very a much nicer man actually, most attractive personality, but not such a great good admiral.
What do you look for in an officer at that rank that he lacked?
Oh, I don't think Duncan was decisive enough. Right or wrong, Ephraim Holmes was a very decisive man, and you knew exactly where you stood with him. I think with Duncan, you weren't quite so sure because he vacillated somewhat. I can't think what the episodes were, but where I got these impressions, but I did. During my time as Commander-in-Chief, no great thing happened. I mean, there were no Falklands Wars, no real crises. So it's rather hard to sort of pin down what is worth saying.
Well, when you went to, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but when you went to NATO, for example, for these meetings, these would be on a fortnightly basis or more?
Less often than that.
Less often than that, yes. And you were engaged really in a policy of management, or were there policy decisions to be taken?
Oh, I used to have meeting of all the commanders. I had meetings, for instance, with all my subordinate commanders, Iceland, Faroes, Lisbon, Gibraltar. Where else? No, that's a lot for East, for the East Atlantic, where you discuss policy and strategy. And equally, those meetings took place at Norfolk, Virginia, in Sackland's case, and in Europe with, in my Sink Chan hat. So we went to Brussels, and one went to Norfolk, Virginia. But I also, of course, had the Mediterranean under my command, and there wasn't a Mediterranean fleet. That had died. But we did go to Malta and to the Mediterranean a lot with the ships still. And during my time there, I went to Malta quite frequently.
I'm sorry. What year is this roughly?
1971.
At 1971. Mm. And the Mediterranean fleet had
died. Yes,
gone by then. Mm-hmm. When was the Mintoff problem? When the Navy? I thought that was later. Perhaps that was that time.
I'll tell you. At the end of my time as Commander in Chief, I went to Malta to say farewell to the Governor, Maurice Dorman, and give my official farewell to him, and also to call on the Prime Minister, Don Mintoff. I got there on this arranged visit in the week when Don Mintoff sacked the Governor, and having done that, refused to see the Commander-in-Chief. So I found myself with, I think, 3 or 4 days in Malta with no Governor to call on or to be entertained by or do anything with. So I didn't see Maurice Dorman. I had known him before, and no Prime Minister to see, because he wasn't going to see me. He went off in one of his more discourteous moods. So I went on more boat picnics during those few days with Admiral Kent, who was the flag officer Malta. We still had a flag officer Malta at that time, but no fleet. I came back home again, having not been very successful in my farewells. But that was the time of the major break with the United Kingdom. There have been very rumblings, forewarnings of this going on for some time. But I had previously been in Malta with almost the whole fleet. I remember going around all the ships and addressing them and having a big meeting in Ark Royal with all my commanding officers. She was there. But mine was always a fleeting visit. I also went down there on a very nostalgic trip. Hermes, my previous carrier, was about to pay off and be converted to a... The idea was converted to a commando carrier at that time. And she was flying off her aircraft for the last time. And I flew down to Malta and embarked in Hermes in order to take part in the very last fixed wing launch from that deck. And I flew back home in the back seat of a Buccaneer, and the last jet launch ever from Hermes, except it wasn't the last jet launch, because one aircraft went to US on the catapult and so had to be sent off the next day. So I didn't quite achieve my aim, but very nearly. What was very interesting about that flight was that the doctors intervened and said, no, the Commander-in-Chief should not fly in a Buccaneer. The doctor said that unless he does a full medical, which involved going into the tank at Gosport and being submerged and turned over, etc., he shouldn't fly. I can't remember what it was called, unless I did that. But we argued this was absolute nonsense, and then it was agreed that provided the aeroplanes didn't fly higher than 20,000 feet on returning to the Mediterranean, it was all right, the Commander-in-Chief could fly. The doctors had a good reason for this, because previously Admiral Gretton, Peter Gretton, had been in a Sea Vixen aircraft when there was an explosive decompression, and he'd survived it amazingly. because the pilot came down quickly to a proper height. But they didn't want this to happen again, so it was a reasonable worry. So we flew at 20,000 feet, and as we approached the French coast, the air traffic controllers put us up to 35,000 feet, and we came back at that height all the way. Not much the doctors could do about that. So I had an interesting flight back in the Buccaneer from Hermes. That's one of my Malta visits. I did quite a lot of NATO visiting, obviously. I think one visit was to Admiral Rivera, the CNC of the Mediterranean Command, SINC-NAV-MED, in Naples. Rivitz Rivera, a tiny little man, and the only Puerto Rican to get to Admiral's rank, I think, in the US Navy. There may have been others since, but at that time he was quite a distinguished personality.
Was there any Soviet activity in the Med?
Yes, there was. Well, on one trip, for example, when I flew out to I was flying out to Cyprus, and I arrived about 2 a.m. and I was met by a rather agitated liaison officer. I had a liaison officer in Cyprus with the army, with a rather agitated liaison officer with a dirty bit of paper in his hand, which he'd torn off the pad in his hotel and written down the telephone call he'd received. And the telephone call he'd received was that HMS Ark Royal had a collision